Waddell and Rebecca Ruffin.
Good morning. Begin?
You sure?
Thanks. Good morning, Your Honors. My name's Jack Sheridan. I'm representing Becky Ruffin on this appeal. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, if I may.
Two?
Yes, please. Your Honors, this is a real important case. The Public Records Act intends liberal construction to ensure that the people do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies that serve them. It represents the natural evolution of government's response to remedial legislation that's intended to provide for more transparent government. This focuses on the Public Records Office, and it's our view that the operation of the Public Records Office must be above the fray. It must be independent of other city interests, and that the public records officer must have tunnel vision and simply respond to requests in a vacuum. The evolution of the city's approach to the PRA has been to intertwine the public records office with the litigation team that's defending the city. This becomes a fox in the hen house scenario. Of course, the guide for all of us on the main issue of the smoking gun is neighborhood, which provides the legal framework. The question is, should the smoking gun have been produced back in 2012, or was it okay to produce it in 2015 as part of the PRA litigation?
And the question is whether or not the search was adequate?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
It's not really the question of whether it was produced or not, or whether it was found or not. It's whether the search was designed to ferret out this
excellent
repeat of information.
Excellent point. But my point is that but for the Public Records Act litigation, which was actually brought to focus on the Mike Haynes Diddy Do Three hiring processes, which was the issue that got us into the PRA litigation, we didn't see the smoking gun coming. We found it because a very diligent attorney had a public records officer in 2015 do a search in response to an interrogatory. We wouldn't be here today but for the Public Records Act litigation on the smoking gun issue. But
now we're talking about Gary Miyahara's email?
Yeah, the Exhibit 1. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just so we're all clear about your smoking gun.
Absolutely. That's it. So it's our view that if you use neighborhood as our framework and we use its fact pattern, we can draw a similarity that is unstoppable. And that is, you know, there were the two computers, the old computer and the new computer, and a person who I guess is just an employee, not a public records officer, decides to produce stuff off the new one and not off the old, and that's what causes the problem. But here we have this mix between what is the public records office and who is working on the process and the litigation team. So we know that Exhibit 65 is the tort claim. On July 30th, she files that tort 2012. She files the tort claim alleging retaliation and other claims. So that's July 30th. August 15th, she sends Ms. Ruffin sends the PRA request asking for the emails that should have produced that smoking gun. On the 24th, Josh Walters, who is now, remember, he's in the PRA office, he's working with Gary Mahara, he sends the tort claim to the litigation, he asked for the tort claim from the litigation paralegal. He reads it. It's in his testimony that he reads it, and he forwards it to his boss, Mr. Mahara. So we didn't know this through that litigation, and so that is an important fact in analyzing what should they have done and when should they have done it. So what we find is that in October, then, Mr. Walters asked Ms. Ruffin to reduce the scope of her request, and that becomes the basis for them saying they didn't produce it. That's Exhibit 10.
Can I ask you a question?
That's September 28th, though, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Your briefing and the city's as well, I mean, there was a a bench trial on this Public Records Act case. And the trial court made findings of fact. Okay, no, so nobody seems to be using the findings of fact. Are you suggesting we just ignore them?
No, I'm suggesting that they're really narrow and that you need to look bigger. The findings of fact, remember, only...
If the findings of fact are not adequate to fully resolve a case and arrive at a conclusion, don't you need to explain that in your brief and assign error to the findings of fact and then argue that?
Well, we assigned error to the conclusions, and we said there was not substantial evidence. We didn't say, you know, findings of fact 6 is inadequate, but we think that our approach saying that there was not substantial evidence, given the fact that it's their burden, was absolutely adequate.
Well, so you would agree then that as with normally with findings of fact, there are verities.
They are, but they're also limited to what they say. So if there's not substantial, even if you accept those as true, there's not substantial evidence because the judge focused on Josh Walter. Josh Walter is simply a tool. He's a tool of the defense.
Are you saying that there's not substantial evidence to support the findings of fact, or are you saying that the conclusions that the court drew do not flow from the findings?
Yes, that's right.
The latter.
That is right.
Okay.
That's right. So what we have here is we have...
Are you saying that the trial court made a mistake by failing to find that there was some problem with relying on Josh Walters?
No, we're saying that by resolving the issue of whether he thought he was credible, that doesn't provide substantial evidence for the conclusions because the city is the defendant. Josh Walters is just a minor player. Gary Mahara is the person who was making those decisions. Ms. Davana Johnson is the person who was making those decisions. So whether or not he was credible, he's like a minor player who may be credibly doing his or her job, but that doesn't determine whether or not there is substantial evidence to support their burden, which is that...
Do you disagree that his search was adequate?
No, his search was absolutely inadequate. Inadequate.
And in what way, then?
Well, it was inadequate. I'd say you have to look at what did they know and when did they know it, right? So here's what we know. That, again, we have to focus on the city, not on him, but Mahara, Johnson, and Haynes are involved.
Walters is the one who conducted the search.
But he's...
Right?
But he's.
So don't we want to know what he did and whether or not it was adequate or not?
Well, we want to know what he did, but its adequacy is measured by what they knew and what they didn't know. And, I mean, what he says is, you know, I searched this and I didn't search that. That's okay. That's not the test. The test is what did the city do, not what did Mr. Mahara do. Walters do? Here's what we have.
The only way the city can act is through its employees.
But that's my point, Your Honor, is that Gary Mahara was the public records officer. This guy was just an employee working for him. Gary Mahara, from his testimony, and if you look at Josh Walters' testimony.
What did Mahara do or not do then?
Well, that's the point, is he was the legal affairs advisor at the same time he was the public records officer. Mahara reported to Carrasco. Our big challenge was trying to connect the dots at the upper end. In 2012, Mahara was also the interim human resource director reporting to Davana Johnson, Exhibit 37. He was the public records officer. That's in the testimony of Mr. Walter. And I have more to say, but I guess I'll wait.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. Michael Ryan, Assistant City Attorney. What Mr. Fien is focused on in our opening remarks was the August search August request that then turned into a modified September request. And the judge did make factual findings in that regard because the question of whether or not a search is adequate under the PRA is a factual question. It depends on the facts and circumstances of each case. Now, Ms. Rafine was afforded a very unique opportunity in this case. She actually had a trial in a Public Records Act case. I looked through the FOIA cases, and I've looked through the Washington reports, and I have never seen a trial on the question of whether or not the city conducted or an agency conducted an adequate search. As best I can tell, this is the first time a trial.
Great. So we've got more information than we usually do, and it's a slightly different procedure. But the question remains,
yes.
You know, did they or didn't they do an adequate search? Now, if I understand correctly the point that Ms. Rufino is making, it's that Mr. Mehara was the designated recipient of an email, and Mr. Mehara did not testify. And the argument is that Mr. Mehara must have remembered getting that email. How could he not have? And yet, you know, it didn't show up. He should have, as the public records officer, remembered that he was the recipient of that email, notwithstanding the fact that he was not one of the designated names being searched. And he must have remembered it. And it's incredible that he didn't. So therefore, he must have deliberately withheld that email from the records that were returned to Ms. Rufino's search. Now, am I understanding the argument?
I believe that's the theory, and I'll tell you why it doesn't hold any water.
Okay.
Because first off, that exact argument was made to the trial court in a factual setting. And the judge concluded that basically what Ms. Rufino is arguing is that Gary Mehara was the obvious lead. Right? That because under Neighborhood Alliance, you must follow obvious leads. You don't have to look in every place a record is conceivably located. And what had happened with that request was Mr. Walter, who actually did all the work on the request, so focusing on what Mr. Walter did is important. So he went and did these searches because Mr. Fien had a very broad search asking for any emails with my name in it, basically back to 2005. Mr. Walter returned hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of documents of emails. And he said to Mr. Fien, you know, I'm getting a lot of information here. Is this what you're looking for? Why don't you come in? Mr. Fien actually came in to the city, and Mr. Walter printed out several documents. And
okay,
she said,
but the argument is, as I understand it, Mr. Walter Schmalters, he was a low-level guy, and you know, we're not concerned. He did everything he could, et cetera. But we're worried about Mr. Mehara, apparently, who was not called as a witness, and I don't know whose problem that is, but the situation we have is that the trial court made findings, but the trial court's findings do not address this argument that Mr. Mehara must have known.
Well, I think they do.
Whose problem is that?
Well, I think it's their problem, and for several reasons. One, because we're at trial. And I do believe that the burden is on them at that point, because all the case law that talks about where the burden rests are all in the context of summary judgment. And even under summary judgment under the PRA and FOIA, what all an agency has to do is put together an affidavit that's reasonably, that explains it, and there's a presumption of good faith that attaches
who,
it to that.
At trial, who called the witnesses?
They did. Ms. Rufino called all the witnesses. We put on one city witness at the end. That all of the case was done through our own witnesses.
So they assumed the burden at trial.
I believe that they did under just standard trial procedure. And if you look into the PRA places the burden expressly in a couple of instances on an agency. One, when you're claiming an exemption. And two, whether or not you've given a reasonable estimate of time. And under the canon of construction of expressio unio exclusio, the idea that the legislature placed that burden there with respect on an agency and it carries through, and the fact that it didn't do it elsewhere, and that's the Adams case from, I believe, Division 2, which talks about who has the burden in a prisoner type of case with respect to bad faith. And what the court concluded was the PRA only places the burden essentially on an agency in two places. But back to why Mr. Mehara wasn't the obvious lead. One, it overstates the importance of this email tremendously.
By the way, what was the witness that you called? Who was that?
We called a single witness, which was Susan Williams from the city attorney's office, to explain how litigation holds work, because one of the theories was
okay.
They were on litigation hold.
Okay.
But she also testified that the city receives 188 million emails a year, gets over 3,000 requests per year, and basically what Ms. Rufino is arguing is that mathematical precision, perfection, is what's required. And we all know that the cases are very clear from Neighborhood Alliance, Hobbs, the Gold Bar cases. All those cases make clear that simply because you find a document after the fact does not make the search inadequate. Because to do that essentially applies 20/20 hindsight and allows theories to be developed as to why that didn't occur. And now what Mr. Fien's counsel was referring to a lot was this basic conspiracy theory that the judge rejected. Because once you take that away, then we just get down into the nuts and bolts of the particular searches.
Let me ask you this, because I'm a little fuzzy on how this went. The email, which is referred to as a smoking gun, which, if I correctly understand it, it was an email that was addressed to Mr. Mehara.
It was CC'd to him.
CC'd to him. Okay. But now, was that email, that had already been received, and it was a topic at trial? Everybody had a chance to ask whatever questions.
No, that issue actually, I think, is coming before this court in a couple of months with respect to the Rule 60 motion that they made in front of Judge Andrus based on the smoking gun document. So whether or not that had an impact on that trial, whether or not that...
No, I don't mean that. I mean, at this trial, the bench trial on the Public Records Act, that's the issue that's being presented to us. Is that the issue that was presented to the trial court? Did everybody have that email at that time?
Yes.
I'm asking.
Okay. Yes, and what had happened was it came in discovery. And that gets me to our cross-appeal because...
Before you get to your cross-appeal, the city did not provide the five-day response to the March 17th request.
That's
correct. You concede that?
We do concede that.
So that's a violation. You concede that?
We agree it's a violation, but it's not one that penalties go to.
Why not?
Because the court ruled that way, and we think under Sanders those types of violations don't create freestanding penalties. You can evaluate them under Yusufian.
Right, attorney fees, right?
It may, but they don't challenge that in that regard. They don't challenge the fact they weren't penalized, nor do they challenge the trial court's conclusion that Mr. Fien didn't prevail on that claim. That's simply not something they assigned error to.
They did argue it in their brief, though, did they not?
Well, what they argued in their brief was that the award has to be adjusted because they plan on winning on appeal, and therefore that reduction of attorney's fees from 100% down to 25% needs to be readjusted, but they didn't argue that they prevailed on March 17th. What they do argue with respect to March 17th was that the city simply didn't get the documents to Ms. Rafine as quickly as she would have liked, and that the search...
You seem to think there was a strategic reason why they failed to assign error in that regard. What was that?
I don't think it's a strategic decision. I think it's just an oversight, or Ms. Rafine would know better than that, but I don't know why they wouldn't assign error to that. But I do think it's important that they did not assign error to that, because then it is waived, because they didn't provide an opportunity for us to respond to arguments, for example, whether or not they would be a prevailing party. What they focused on the March 17th request was with respect to the fact that Mr. Fien labeled the request times of the essence, and the judge heard all the testimony and explained all the work that Mr. Walter did in responding to that request, and found that under the facts and circumstances, as a matter of fact, that was reasonable. And that's a factual conclusion that we believe is supported by substantial evidence.
Well, sadly, you only have 1 minute for your cross-appeal, so
right.
CR 68.
Right. I think,
say the court erred.
Well, I think the court did, and I think the trial court's conclusion that Rule 68 doesn't categorically does not apply in PRA cases, it's unprecedented, it's not wise, and it's inconsistent with cases from this court as well as the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court's been very clear that a PRA is not a special proceeding, and the civil rules apply in all civil cases.
Simple as that.
It is as simple as that. And in fact, this court last January, in a case we put on for supplemental authority in the John Doe case, ruled that you can have class actions in the context of a PRA case because it's a civil rule, and the civil rule applies in PRA cases. And we've explained in our brief why we believe the policy arguments that the judge advanced, or the textual arguments, are not sufficient to overcome the general rule that the civil rules apply in all PRA cases, and we'll rest on our briefs with that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you going to address the cross appeal?
Sure, but just very quickly. 4256030 says in the event of any conflict, the PRA applies, and 4256554 says that penalties are basically discretionary. You get your fees and your costs. So that's all I have to say on that. I would like to say, though, that the burden is clearly on the defendant. We were simply asked to go first and did by the court. It doesn't change the burden. But I did want to just point out that Mahara was intricately involved in the litigation, and he knew about it before filing. So the smoking
gun. Why wasn't he called as a witness?
Well, we didn't call him as a witness because it wasn't our burden, and I think he was gone by then. But the March. But if you look at Exhibit 1, he is saying, I'm just getting, he's the recipient of the Haynes email that says, I'm just getting caught up on being out and I have not replied to Ms. Rufin. So again, this shows that what he knew in April of 2012, so by August of 2012, his department is just as responsible as before. The March 17th production also, that...
Well, that's your argument, though. I mean, am I correct in my understanding that basically your argument is he must have known. He must have remembered getting that email. So he is the bad guy because he did not bring this up and make sure it was included in the record.
Well, not just him.
And did you ever bring that to the trial court's attention at the end of the trial and say, Your Honor, you should have made a finding that Mr. Mahara must have known?
We did not propose that as a finding, but we pointed out that Ms. Johnson, who destroyed the document, was there, as well as Mr. Haynes and Mr. Kern. We had testimony by deposition. So all of those persons had the knowledge at the time, and the document was not produced. So that's our position. Thank you.
Thank you. And the next